Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back, and it is Now or Never, and that debt is fraud, and we go out of our way to prove and show to you that there's so much money that is fraudulently being taken from us that, folks, you would think that that alone would be the motivation, because 9 times out of 10, when it affects the people's wallet, they start getting active. But apparently, because it is such a huge number, I mean, shoot, they've been doing this for centuries and taking on debt for well over a century and taking on debt, spending money on things they had no authority to do. How can this be illegitimate? Well, we proved to you that. And we actually, that's why we go through this. This is why, again, the Pray, Learn, Pray Act, Pray, Learn Act, what have you. The whole point is learning, seeking, making the appeal to heaven and seeking guides, what you need to do. Because, folks, as we lay this out, the only outcome, the only thing that's going to give us the outcome, I should say, is by demanding full compliance. The process of demanding full compliance is not a convention, not trying to amend the Constitution. The Constitution is not the problem. I defy anybody to prove to me that what the federal government has been doing from chemtrails to energy, it doesn't matter. Prove to me that the Constitution is the problem. It's not. Why would we worry about amending the Constitution when the real problem is the people in government are not following their oath of office and they're actually functioning well outside powers delegated? It's that simple. We hold them accountable. The process of doing that is to call them out in a First Amendment petition when we say, where did we give you the authority to regulate our education, to regulate our health care? Just because the Supreme Court has allowed the aggrandizement of government over the past several centuries, over two plus centuries, they're not helping us. They're not the advocates that they're supposed to be. So if they're not going to do it, and our public servants aren't going to do it, then who's going to do it? Well, most people think that the party's doing it, and we're working with the party to change that paradigm. We've actually tried to work with individuals either running campaigns or actual leadership. And in Wyoming, we've actually got the right direction moving in Wyoming. It takes time. Everybody will acknowledge, and one of the reasons why maybe this isn't popular, maybe why I'm not the number one show for 3 o'clock Pacific Coast time or 6 o'clock East Coast time, is just due to the fact that, we're teaching you the content. We're not asking you to take our word for it. We're reading what they say, and we're laying it out and proving to you how the Constitution evolved. That's what we're covering right now. How it evolved from the legislature, the national legislature, would regulate the number of apportionment or the amount of people who were going to be represented by a representative. It started off with that power granted to Congress that they could regulate that. That was taken out. The only way it could change is through an amendment, which is why James Madison, in the Bill of Rights, created the very first first amendment out of the 12. It was passed by Connecticut, but never acknowledged because they never sent it. Bottom line, we could actually invoke that and get representation today to being 50,000 per one representative. That's the way it should be because the Constitution was actually amended. It was just never sent. All this being said, folks, is that I understand it's not sexy, sitting down with a reading light and reading and following along to understand those things within the Constitution that are so critical to understand that we can hold government accountable. That may not be sexy, but I'm telling you what is sexy, and Sean, you tell me if this is correct or not, that it may not be sexy spending hours in learning and going through these source documents and actually profoundly understanding, wow, GR's right. That what we have in government is not supposed to exist. That they can only do these things. Wow, this is just... That may not be sexy, but what is sexy is when you stand up in front of your community, when you stand up on television and you can profoundly tell them that there is no authority in that Constitution giving this government, whether it be the state, the county, or even the federal government, giving them these powers. Therefore, they have no authority to exercise this. This is what would have shut down Obamacare. This is what would have shut down the EPA. This would have shut down the Health and Human Services or shut down the Department of Homeland Security. I could go on and on and on. Labor. They have no authority to be doing these things. And as nice as it is to have these intellectuals who basically state, you know, these intellectual arguments like, you know, Thomas Sowell talking about, you know, by them doing these things, they have these bad cause, you know, the cause and effect and so forth. Yeah, that's good. But don't you want to win? Don't you want to be right? I mean, and I guess in economic theory, Thomas Sowell isn't wrong. He's right. But when it comes to the Constitution, what ends the tyranny at the end of the day is the fact that they don't have the authority. I wish Thomas Sowell would have taken, you know, a little time to become a little more literate on the Constitution, because he would have been a very powerful man, very powerful and influential man today. They probably would have killed him. Or maybe he does understand the Constitution. That's why he bites his tongue, because he's not willing to risk his life. I understand. But when we, the people, start demanding compliance with the Constitution, it's the cat's out of the bag. It's done. So am I right, Sean, that it may not be sexy learning about the Constitution, but it is very sexy standing up in front of people and profoundly speaking regarding the Constitution? Am I right or wrong?
Well, I don't know if you're right. I wouldn't say it's sexy, okay. But I like it.
Yeah, because it does. The message is irrefutable. It's almost like shining the light. You know, hey, can you shine some light over here? Wow, that is light. I mean, it's the truth. So when people... Go ahead.
The truth shall set you free.
Yes. So if the people really understood how powerful it is to stand up and make an assertion that nobody could refute, then that's very powerful. I mean... It gives a person this affirmation. But the interesting thing is the power is not personal. The power is a matter of fact. You're only stating fact. This isn't about you. It's not about me. This is about the fact. This is about the law, the actual law that we're supposed to be abiding by. And when people start understanding this, then to me, this is what changes everything. This is what causes movements. Folks, why don't you want to be a part of a movement? It just baffles me. But I can only make the appeal through these speakers you listen to this with. I don't have the ability to actually go into everybody's home and get people to open up their door. But I will say this. You, the listeners, you should be telling people, as you've been learning, man, if you're not listening to GR, then you're really clueless as to what really is happening. Yeah, there's all of these geopolitical things that's going on even right now. But most of it's all unconstitutional. And to do things right, we've got to do it constitutionally. We have to stop, because it's killed lots of young Americans. It has caused all sorts of deaths by allowing government to do things unconstitutionally, assuming powers unconstitutionally, because every time they've assumed the power, they have actually weaponized that. And I'll even give credit to Milton Friedman. He's the one that said, give the federal government the ability to regulate the Sahara Desert, and they will run out of sand within 5 years.
That's the truth.
Because that's how they're built to fail in those things. The one thing they're built to succeed in is fighting wars. Yeah. So That's why, you know, if we were doing things right, we would not have this huge political, I'll just say, war machine. We would actually have a streamlined war machine that would actually be able to do the job, save us a lot of money, and actually still be the world power. There's no reason why we would not be the world power. The only problem is that we've created this huge, large apparatus that is not constitutional. All for the purpose of allowing more people to obtain 4 stars on their shoulder, 3 stars, more officer ranks, so forth and so on. The larger you make it, the more people have an opportunity to get promoted. What we're doing is we're covering the Constitutional Convention with Madison, and we're still on July 9th. And actually, we just kind of finished these comments talking about the, you know, states coming into the union, as well as apportionment and so forth. And we just ended a couple of days ago because we kind of got derailed a little bit on, you know, these ancillary but important topics. The point is, folks, is that this next phase that we're going to be reading is really more kind of administrative, because Mr. Martin then kind of speaks up and, you know, asks a question. And then next thing you know, there's a few motions on the floor and they do some voting and so forth. And so I would encourage you to go ahead and kind of read through this. But I think if we skim down to Mr. Williamson at the very bottom of page, or towards the very bottom of page 159, you'll find that he starts talking once again about property, because you're going to notice that they spend a lot of time. Why do you think they're spending so much time on this property apportionment and everything else?
It's going to decide the power and the influence of the states.
And the funding of the federal government. Because the apportionment comes with a tax. You're going to get this representation in government, but you're going to be paying a certain tax for that apportionment. And that's how they're going to divvy out the apportionment per state. So each state will pay their fair share. So as we, you know, as we look, this is really important. Because you get it right, then, you know, as it goes forward for ratification, they go, hey, if there's anything that smells like it's unfair, this is going to give an advantage to this, then you actually find, oh, wow, you know, that just killed it. They needed to make sure, and there were some real power plays, i.e. slavery and so forth. And as a matter of fact, if you look up the very beginning, what Mr. Martin, the question he asked, I'll just go ahead and read this. He wished to know whether the committee were guided in the ratio by wealth or number of inhabitants of the states, or by both, noting its variations from former apportionments by Congress. Because Congress, the Continental Congress, was trying to figure out how to lay that out. And they never came up with the success. And the real problem, you got, it sounds like you have a hurricane there. It just sounds like a lot of wind just hit you.
No, okay. I don't think so.
So the real problem that Continental Congress had really nothing to do with how they were laying out the apportionment. It was the ability to go and get it, the ability to enforce it. And so when we get into these, you know, discussions and so forth, they want to, you know, sideline, they make some motions, so forth. Let's get to the property after they go through these different votes and so forth, and we can kind of move forward as how this is kind of maturing. This is still in the, I would call it, still in the infantile stage. It's still young and it's still growing, and they're still trying to figure out, even to the very end, they still had issues regarding state sovereignty, slavery, and so forth. They may have came up with what they considered the appropriate compromises, but they were still so concerned that at the very end of the convention, they injected the 2 amendment protection clauses to ensure that these compromises couldn't be messed with. to ensure that there would be no intrigue, political intrigue, that would undermine what they all decided to do, because they didn't necessarily trust each other blindly. And that was the brilliant part of all of this. But let's go ahead and pick up what Mr. Wilson says.
Mr. Wilson.
It's the property. It's, if you just go down a couple of people, it's Mr. Wilson, North Carolina.
Okay.
Property, yeah, right there.
Property. I have Mr. Patterson from New Jersey. I don't see Mr. Wilson.
Okay, the very bottom, towards the bottom of 159, when we look at Mr. Martin, then Mr. Sherman, then Governor Morris, this is all on July 9th. So July 9th, we went through and kind of stopped with Mr. Gorham, which was the third person speaking on that day. And then Mr. Martin was the next person, Mr. Sherman, Mr. Governor Morris, and then Mr. Williamson of North Carolina.
Okay.
Okay. All right.
And, yeah, you read the part about Mr. Martin.
Yeah, I just kind of summarized to basically say how when he started talking about the property and the apportionment, it kind of derailed and they went into these motions. And so to take, as they made these decisions, now Mr. Martin wanted to get things going back to, you know, let's talk about property.
Okay. So Mr. Williamson from North Carolina?
Yes. Yes. I'm sorry. Yes, correct. Mr. Williamson.
You said Wilson. That's why I couldn't find it.
No. My bad. My bad. Okay. You're right.
Mr. Williamson, North Carolina, property. Though it would be necessary to return to the rule of numbers, but that the Western states stood on different footing. If their property shall be rated as high as that of the Atlantic states, then their representation ought to hold a like proportion. Otherwise, if their property was not to be equally rated.
Okay, so again, they were looking at ways of creating a system that would create a disadvantage based on something that would be subjective. Because really, when you look at property, I don't know if you've ever seen somebody buy something that, you know, costs, wow, I mean, you spent that much money on that? And beauty's in the eye of the beholder. The value is based on the perceived value of the buyer. If the buyer really feels like it is worth that. So when you allow, like, the real estate, the MLS, and the way they create the value based on financing, you know, what the bank would say, okay, we'll finance it at this level, based on, what do they call that? There's a word for the values of the property of the area. It is, help me out here. There's a term
comps
that they use. What's that? Comps. Something like that. I think it is comps. But yeah, Anyway, in comparisons, right? In comparison to the property around you, your property can't be out of that range. I sold a house that was well beyond the comps, and I had no problem selling it. It took me less than 2 weeks during Christmas to sell a house. You'd think that you can't sell a house at Christmas, and you definitely can't break comps and that paradigm, but you can if the house is actually well above and the value is well above the comps. Even though it may look like the standard house and the standard, that if you've actually done those things, and a buyer walks in and says, man, this is a great value, even though it's higher than I would want to pay. As a matter of fact, I talked to the buyer. He says, this is the first house I've ever been excited for buying because it's a steal. And I go, yeah, I know, but you're paying more than what anybody would have allowed me to pay or sell it for. Anyway, so bottom line, they're trying to create this idea of property value. And property value can literally flip-flop and change and so forth. And I understand that there's reasons for that, but I believe that if you start understanding how you can create an advantage for where affluence exists, wouldn't you believe that the affluent would do what they could in making sure that these other states wouldn't become affluent. Does that make sense?
To a certain degree. I mean, in the spirit of competition, but if they're going to be in a union, then they you would think they would want everyone to be successful.
Well, one of the reasons why they inserted the Commerce Clause of the federal government being able to regulate commerce among the states was the fear that the states would actually become competitors, and not only that, but they would actually start to practice, you know, economic warfare or what have you, creating advantages for themselves. So, you know, when it comes to money, you know, really dark and evil things can conspire or come out of, you know, that lust and avarice for the money and control. And so they were trying to make this, but again, North Carolina had a unique property value. It was their slaves. In other words, if you look at their labor was a fixed price and a fixed value. What was the cost of the head of a slave? That was on top of their real estate property and so forth. So they actually saw the advantages of bolstering up property value to give them better apportionment. So anyway, so Governor Morris, let's keep going through this thread here.
It's amazing to me how they wanted it both ways. Yeah. And how at every turn these debates are insight into how they were trying to not control but manage human nature. Like the southern states wanted apportionment for their slaves as people to be represented, but at the same time they wanted a proper property value for their slaves who they considered property.
Right. Yes, correct. So this goes to, you know, what he was saying, as he wanted to make sure that the Western states stood on different footing, but that the Western states stood on different footing. If their property shall be rated as high as the Atlantic states, then their representation ought to hold a like proportion. Otherwise, their property was not to be equally rated. I believe that there was this a fixation that, you know, if it's a slave state, it should be rated higher. If it's not a slave state, then it won't be rated higher. We can get into this more, but this the underlying tone, when you look at, unfortunately, these men, they knew that slavery was being pushed off the table. And that's all these other states wanted to get rid of it. So we'll get to that point where they finally have this real honest conversation. So keep going with the next one with
Mr. Governor Morris, yes. Pennsylvania. Uh-huh. The report is little more than a guess. Wealth was not altogether disregarded by the committee, where it was apparently in favor of one state whose numbers were superior to the numbers of another by a fraction only. A member extraordinary was allowed to the former, and so vice versa. The committee meant little more than to bring the matter to a point for the consideration of the House.
Okay, so Mr. Reed then, from Delaware.
Mr. Reed asked why Georgia was allowed two members when her number of inhabitants had stood below that of Delaware.
Ah, at least so they perceived. They hadn't done the census, right? And so, because we've talked about this, and we've talked about how, I'll just say, what they were saying, like he just said that Georgia had the least amount of population, when in fact the census came out with 59,000 in Georgia and 59,000 in Delaware, both. So they were actually equal. Interestingly enough, you know, they were based on these assumptions of how they were projecting how many people lived there, because they didn't have the accurate numbers. These were all just guesses. And so there was no way Delaware actually was double the size population-wise to Georgia. Anyway, we'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so let's go ahead and just keep going down to the next one. I think Mr. Morris, again, was the next one.
Yeah, that was the one I just read.
Oh, okay.
Oh, no, his second comment.
Right.
Mr. Governor Morris, Pennsylvania, such is the rapidity of the population of that state that before the plan takes effect, it will probably be entitled to two representatives.
Okay, so Mr. Randolph of Virginia.
He disliked the report of the committee but had been unwilling to object to it. He was apprehensive that as the number was not to be changed till a national legislature should please, a pretext would never be wanting to postpone alterations.
Okay.
And keep the power in the hands of those possessed of it.
Uh-huh.
He was in favor of the commitment to a member from each state.
All right, now Mr. Patterson of New Jersey continues this concept of, and kind of picks at this slavery thing. It's actually mentioning the elephant in the room. So, okay, let's go ahead.
Mr. Patterson, New Jersey, considered the proposed estimate for the future according to the combined rule of numbers and wealth as too vague. For this reason, New Jersey was against it. He could regard Negroes, slaves, in no light but as property. They are no free agents, have no personal liberty, no faculty of acquiring property, but on the contrary, are themselves property, and like other property, entirely at the will of the master. He was a man in Virginia, a number of votes in proportion to the number of his slaves. Okay, let me read that again. Has a man in Virginia a number of votes in proportion to the number of his slaves? And if Negroes are not represented in the states to which they belong, why should they be represented in the general government? What is the true principle of representation? It is an expedient by which an assembly of certain individuals chosen by the people is substituted in place of the inconvenient meeting of the people themselves. If such a meeting of the people is actually to take place, would the slaves vote? They would not. Why then should they be represented? He was also against such an indirect encouragement of the slave trade, observing that Congress in their act relating to the charge of the 8th Article of Confederation had been ashamed to use the term slaves and had substituted a description.
Okay. So here, New Jersey now really opens the door, right? And this is, he's just stating the obvious. And he's actually tying, you know, a good argument here. Well, there's, you know, hey, hold on here. It doesn't matter whether you perceive, you know, slaves as property or not. That's how we perceive it. And we're paying money, good money for this stuff. And so, again, as politically incorrect these conversations are, they understand that they're creating a union that will need to defend itself against some pretty evil nations. So, Mr. Madison now pipes in on this, you know, concept of slavery and property. Go ahead.
Mr. Madison reminded Mr. Patterson that his doctrine of representation, which was in its principle the genuine one, must forever silence the pretensions of the small states to an equality of votes with the large ones. They ought to vote in the same proportion in which their citizens would do, if the people of all the states were collectively met. He suggested as a proper ground of compromise that in the first branch, the states should be represented according to their number of free inhabitants, and in the second, which had for one of its primary objects the guardianship of property, according to the whole number, including slaves.
Okay, so at this point still Madison was not in favor of the state legislature choosing their Senate and dictating what they were to do. Not necessarily, you know, speaking against it, but right here it goes, well, how would that work? If the state legislature would be picking that, wouldn't that be doing that? And so, anyway, he's just talking about the responsibilities, though, right? That the Senate would be guarding the value of property. That, and actually, what he's really saying here is the fundamental principles that I try to teach about our this new era of republicanism or representation of sovereigns. That the sovereigns have different interests. When you have the people, their interest is whether we're going to go to war, how much is it going to cost me, those types of things. When the states are looking at their suffrage and their representation, they have other issues over their sovereignty of what the people have delegated to them. The same applies to your county and or parish governments. Whatever you've delegated to them, they should have those concerns to make sure in the government above them, they should have representation to ensure they have the ability to protect their interests. Okay, so Mr. Butler then of, and I think Butler is South Carolina or North, he's a Carolinian. Go ahead.
Mr. Butler urged warmly the justice and necessity of regarding wealth in the apportionment of representation.
Ah, urged warmly the justice and necessity of regarding wealth in the apportionment of representation. Mr. King.
Mr. King had always expected that as the southern states are the richest, they would not league themselves with the northern unless some respect were paid to their superior wealth. If the latter expect those preferential distinctions in commerce and other advantages which they would derive from the connection, they must not expect to receive them without allowing some advantages in return. 11 out of 13 of the states had agreed to consider slaves in the apportionment of taxation, and taxation and representation ought to go together.
Okay.
On the question of for committing the first paragraph of the report to a member from each state.
Uh-huh.
And they voted. Massachusetts, aye. Connecticut, aye. New York, no. New Jersey, aye. Pennsylvania, aye. Delaware, aye. Maryland, aye. Virginia, aye. North Carolina, aye. South Carolina, no. Georgia, aye.
Okay.
The committee appointed where King shall. Okay, that's the next part.
Okay, so let's go down now. Let's skip a little bit because the conversation kind of continues going on, and they talk about numbers and so forth. But if you go down just to, you know, let me see, is it a whole page? Not, it's almost a whole page down. It's highlighted in blue with Governor Morris of Pennsylvania and talks about property and representation. So let's pick it up at this point and look at how the argument continues because as I look at this, this is now on a new day because technically that comment and that voting was at the end of the ninth. Now this is the next day. So they're still continuing. I mean, folks, there was so much effort figuring out apportionment and represent this Republican form of government and how to do this. This wasn't something that, the difficulty wasn't in, guarding against ex post facto laws and all the, those things were like just second nature. When they started putting those things in restriction. Oh, yeah, we've got to include this. Oh, yeah, there's another evil thing. There it is. So let's go ahead with Mr. Morris, Governor Morris.
Mr. Governor Morris, Pennsylvania, on property and representation, regretted the turn of the debate. The states he found had many representatives on the floor. Few, he fears, were to be deemed the representatives of America. He thought the southern states have, by the report, more than their share of representation. Property ought to have its weight, but not all the weight. If the southern states are to supply money, the northern states are to spill their blood. Besides, the probable revenue to be expected from the southern states has been greatly overrated. He was against reducing New Hampshire.
Right, so there it is right there. Right? Blood over slavery. So that they can protect their slave institution, they're going to be providing us money so that we can go die for them. What is the greater value here? Are our lives greater than their money? Are our lives greater than their liberty? This really starts creating, to me, this, you know, this deep philosophical argument that these men were facing. Keep going with Mr. Randolph of Virginia.
Mr. Randolph of Virginia was opposed to a reduction of New Hampshire, not because she had a full title to three members, but because it was in his contemplation, one, to make it the duty instead of leaving it in, leaving it in the discretion of the legislature to regulate the representation by a periodical census. Two, to require more than a bare majority of votes in the legislature in certain cases, and particularly in commercial cases.
Okay, so right there, he exposes this idea that the reason he was opposed to a reduction was that he wanted to make sure that the federal legislature would be able to regulate the representation by periodical census. You see that, right?
Yes, sir.
And so that was a paradigm that basically would grant Congress the ability to determine a change in, you know, that number of representation. So in other words, that language needs to be in the Constitution that Congress shall regulate. But guess what? Because that means that would be, where would that apportionment and the regulation be? That would actually move it from Article 1, Section 2 down to Article 1, Section 8. The Congress shall have the power to regulate the apportionment of representation for states. Left it up to their discretion and how that discretion would have been done. Okay, so then they voted on this. Okay, so basically, on the question for reducing New Hampshire from 3-2, it passed in the negative. In other words, you know, he wanted to keep it up, and they said, no, we're going to reduce it. And then I don't think they got into the question of whether Congress should regulate it and that language, not at this point. So they had a few other votes, right, and they went through these different representations allowed. Now, this is where they were really talking more specifically about representations for the states. And then we get to the red, where Madison all of a sudden starts talking about admitting states into the Union again, or there's this subtext of this. Let's go ahead.
Mr. Madison moved that the number allowed to each state be doubled. A majority of a quorum of 65 members was too small a number to represent the whole inhabitants of the United States. They would not possess enough of the confidence of the people and would be too sparsely taken from the people to bring with them all the local information which would be frequently wanted. Double the number would not be too great, even with the future additions from new states. The additional expense was too inconsiderable to be regarded in so important a case. And as far as the augmentation might be unpopular on that score, the objection was overbalanced by its effect on the hopes of a greater number of the popular candidates.
Okay. Now, as we look, Mr. Ellsworth then kind of pipes in. So go ahead.
Urged the objection of expense and that the greater the number, the more slowly would the business proceed, and the less probably be decided as it ought at last.
Okay.
He thought the number of representatives too great in most of the state legislatures, and that a large number was less necessary in the general legislature than in those of the states, as its business will relate to a few great national objects only.
Okay, so here's an interesting dichotomy. Madison is looking at a Republican form of government, and Mr. Ellsworth is actually looking more towards either an aristocracy or a oligarchy, because he wants to confine government to a few people, apparently that, you know, they would be the smartest, and they would be, the, like I said, an aristocracy or an oligarchy, where it kind of was flying in the face of what they were really trying to do. This goes back to why, and I say this a lot, when we talk about a Republican form of government, what is good, what is the number for a good representative? I mean, at the federal level, when you look at what they're supposed to, what they have delegated powers to do, very little affects us. So do we need to have a few people to efficiently do, because the whole point here is that an oligarchy or an aristocracy can manage and run government more efficient than a large pool of representatives. Well, if government doesn't have that much power, that much things that they can do, then why worry about the efficiency of government when they can't meddle with hardly anything? Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. I was just going to say that. I mean, I don't know if maybe I just have a bad taste in my mouth for the word oligarchy, but it would make sense, as he's saying, that if they only have a few things that they're supposed to be dealing with, then why would they need all of those people?
Right. So
if they're taking, the Senate is taking direction from the state legislatures, and the representatives are representing the people, then I would think they, you know, I understand it both ways, but at the same time, you looking at it from what we have now, it's hard to get a.
Oh yeah, but okay. So look at the next argument now, because here's a new spin on, you know, why you don't want to make it too big because of the cost of travel and so forth. So go ahead and read what Mr. Sherman says.
Mr. Sherman would have preferred 50 to 65. The great distance they will have to travel will render their attendance precarious and will make it difficult to prevail on a sufficient number of fit men to undertake the service. He observed that the expected increase from new states also deserved consideration.
Yes. Okay. And how far they had to travel and the burdens that would be for them. Okay. So, but remember, the concept had already been laid out that their salary would come from the Treasury. In other words, their compensation of travel, what have you, would the government would pay for them to do their job. So I'm not sure if that's really a good argument, other than keep in mind, Mr. Sherman is in his, not the geriatric retirement, but he's close. He's old. He's been doing this for a while. And from traveling from Connecticut, look at the map. Traveling from Connecticut to D.C. is nothing like traveling from Georgia to D.C. or up New Hampshire to D.C. I mean, you know, it's, you're right there on the water. You could literally take a boat and travel down and probably just as fast, if that makes sense. As a matter of fact, when Thomas Jefferson retired, he put all of his goods and he actually traveled down the Potomac and down to Norfolk, where he disembarked and took the road out to Monticello. That's where his stuff got stolen and where, you know, he had that, I'll call it his facsimile, what they called it back then. His facsimile got damaged, was by these two thieves. And those two thieves were hanged for stealing that and damaging his property. Anyway, little side note. Okay, so now Mr. Gary basically said this. Let's go with Mr. Gary.
Mr. Gary was for increasing the number beyond 65. The larger the number, the less the danger of their being corrupted. Good point. The people are accustomed to and fond of a numerous representation and will consider their rights as better secured by it. The danger of excess in the number may be guarded against by fixing a point within which the number shall always be kept.
Yes. Mr. Mason. Let's keep, yeah, keep going.
Colonel Mason admitted that the objection drawn from the consideration of expense had weight both in itself and as the people might be affected by it. But he thought it outweighed by the objections against the smallness of the number 38, will he supposes, as being a majority of 65 form a quorum. 20 will be a majority of 38. This is certainly too small a number to make laws for America. They would neither bring with them all the necessary information relative to various local interests, nor possess the necessary confidence of the people. After doubling the number, the laws might still be made by so few as almost to be objectionable on that account.
Okay, so now if we don't even have full quorum, then they can't even do anything. So just by the bare numbers, that would, he's pointing out these other arguments of, we need to have more. Okay, Mr. Reed, go ahead.
Mr. Reed was in favor of the motion. Two of the states, Delaware and Rhode Island, would have but a single member if the aggregate number should remain at 65. And in case of accident to either one of these, one state would have no representative present to give explanations or information of its interests or wishes. The people would not place their confidence in so small a number. He hoped the objects of the general government would be much more numerous than seemed to be expected by some gentlemen, and that they would become more and more so. As to new states, the highest number of reps for the whole might be limited and all danger of excess thereby prevented.
Okay. Again, they're not liking new states coming in and having equal footing. Mr. Rutledge.
Mr. Rutledge opposed the motion. The representatives were too numerous in all the states. The full number allotted to the states may be expected to attend, and the lowest possible quorum should not therefore be considered. The interests of their constituents will urge their attendance too strongly for it to be omitted, and he supposed general legislature would not sit more than 6 or 8 weeks in the year.
Okay, so now we kind of skip over a couple of things, and by the way, if you start looking at where these guys are hailing from, some of these guys are hailing from the South, where they like doing business by, you know, small oligarchies and or aristocracies, because the people that have the money should be the ones that should be really the govern. I mean, this goes down eventually. The argument, once the Constitution is ratified and once the overreach of government in the 1820 with the Missouri Compromise and so forth galvanizes slavery, and they undo what the divine hand of providence put in motion as a slow eradication of slavery to, you know, the Missouri Compromise that basically pulled the rug out from underneath that. And so I believe it was in the 1830s, around that time, George Fitzhugh, an academic, and I believe he was a Southern academic, began arguing. Actually, I think he published some books in the 1850s and 60s, but he started, you know, his professorial or, you know, his teachings at, you know, around the, I think, 1830s, 1840s. Again, he published these books, and his argument was that If you could not run a plantation so that you could adequately provide a quality of life for yourself and your slaves, and you just struggled, or you couldn't even, you know, employ slaves, if you can't employ people, then you need to be a slave or you need to be an employee. In other words, kind of creating this caste system that people that were capable of employing and had the money and so forth, they would be the masters, and both white and black would be slaves. In other words, it was the beginning of the idea of communism, where everybody would be subjects to the states, but instead of the states were plantations. And the plantations would make sure they would be benevolent providers, that they would make sure that the needs and the care and the health and those types of things were going to be provided. So anyway, let's dive into Mr. Boom and then Randolph and on to Governor Morris again. Go ahead.
He must have been a Democrat, huh?
Yeah. Well, most Southerners were at that point, yep. Yep.
They loved their slaves.
Yes.
Mr. Broome gave notice to the House that he had concurred with the reserve to himself of an intention to claim for his state an equal voice in the second branch, which he thought could not be denied after this concession of the small states as to the first branch.
Okay. So, again, out of the blue, hey, we still need to have equal suffrage in the second branch. Not talking about slavery representation together. They just wanted to make sure we all agreed that we were going to have this equal suffrage. It sounds like we might be losing that here. Go ahead with Mr. Randolph.
Mr. Randolph moved as an amendment to the report of the Committee of Five that in order to ascertain the alterations in the population and wealth of the several states, the legislature should be required to cause a census, an estimate to be taken within 1 year after its first meeting and every blank years thereafter, and that the legislature arrange the representation accordingly.
Okay, so that language kindly made it in, but it wasn't the state, it was the federal government would actually, they didn't conduct it, they paid for it. Because they wanted to make sure that there was truly proper representation and it was fairly done across all of the states. Because if they didn't have a mechanism and have that transparency, what would have happened was the accusations of, hey, you're giving these guys favors. Okay, so Governor Morris, go ahead.
Mr. Governor Morris opposed it as fettering the legislature too much. Advantage may be taken of it in time of war or the apprehension of it by new states to extort particular favors. If the mode was to be fixed for taking a census, it might certainly be extremely inconvenient. If unfixed, the legislature may use such mode as will defeat the object and perpetuate the inequality. He was always against such shackles on the legislature. They have been found very pernicious in most of the state constitutions. He dwelt much on the danger of throwing such a preponderancy into the Western scale, suggesting that in time the Western people would outnumber the Atlantic states. He wished, therefore, to put it in the power of the latter to keep a majority of votes in their own hands. It was objected, he said, that if the legislature are left at liberty, they will never readjust the representation. He admitted that this was possible, but he did not think it probable unless the reasons against a revision of it were very urgent, and in this case, it ought not to be done.
Okay, so right there we're going to stop because we just got seconds left of the show. I want to go back and really look at what he said because remember, it was Governor Morris who made the suggestion that the Western states would be diminished in power so that they couldn't obtain, you know, control and overpower, and he brings it up again here. The question is, did I just sense Governor Morris, or did you just sense Governor Morris actually changing his perspective and thinking that they should have equal footing now that common sense, logic, and reason has come out of Virginia in challenging the paradigm? Are you sure you want to actually create a diminishment in power and not equal? Because you're just postponing the next revolution instead of, you know, giving everybody equality and a fair shot. So anyway, with that, we're going to get going. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, process. This is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.